we're only at the beginning, and a lot of these technologies you mentioned, they are intersecting. So AI intersecting the metaverse, and then things like crypto and cryptocurrencies or blockchain or Ethereum, where, you know, things like authenticity or authentication of entities through blockchain technology. Just the way those three technologies are crossing over each other, it's phenomenal.
Hi, I'm Mike Abel. I'm a business, marketing and communication specialist and the founder of MNC Saatchi Abel. I'm a family man, a problem solver, a futurist and an optimist at heart. Welcome to my podcast, Willing and Able, the home of hopeful conversations that challenge perspectives. It's a continuation of the ideas and conversations I began in my book, Willing and Able, Lessons from a Decade in Crisis. My guest today is Dr. Nick Bradshaw. Nick is a tech-focused entrepreneur, helping clients, communities, and startups understand the value of AI, automation, and digital solutions. He is the founder of the South African AI Association, which aims to boost economic growth, don't we need that, trade, investment, equality, and inclusivity in South Africa. And his company, AI Media Group, runs the AI Expo Africa. So great to have you here today, Nick.
Yeah, it's great to be with you, Mike, and thanks for inviting me.
Absolute pleasure. We're going to have a rich conversation. So I always like to go back a little bit and, you know, AI being something so new, and somebody like yourself, I called you Dr. Nick. I see you've got a DPhil in chemistry. How did you get into AI? What brought you towards this amazing new space that some of us only have learned about in the last 18 months?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, my original background and training was, as you say, chemistry, science, if you want to call it in its broadest sense. And I studied chemistry and business studies as a bachelor's degree. And then I really enjoyed analytical science. And there was the opportunity to do a 3-year extension and do a PhD, which I really enjoyed. And I was really looking at statistical measurements in analytical systems. There's a lot of statistics and maths involved. I was looking at precision and accuracy in those systems. And actually, sort of, you know, 25, 30 years later, that same interest in the application of that into the world of AI, which is pretty much statistics and maths on steroids,
yeah,
in the form of an algorithm in a computer. Yeah, it really interested me. And I built a business here in South Africa and it got acquired. It was just a genuine passion to take a year off and then get into a new subject. And AI and automation's always intrigued me. Obviously, the fundamental technology and thinking behind it has been around for a long time, but now with cloud computing, enhancements with chip technology, some of the things of, you know, we wanted to do decades ago and are possible even on your phone. So yeah, it's an exciting time. It's an exciting discipline. And I just realized there was a gap in the market to fill people's understanding from a sort of business and real world perspective. So the world of academia and research has been looking at this for years and decades, and there's a very active community in South Africa and wider Africa. The business community was missing that community and an event to bring everybody together. So that's what I started work on.
Amazing. So you said something really interesting, or you said a lot of very interesting things, but one of the things you touched on is selling your business. Now, when one has a successful business and you enjoy doing it, I always think it's a remarkably brave thing as an entrepreneur myself and somebody, you know, with a business that I could sell but have chosen not to. What was it that made you decide to sell your business? I know timing is everything, but maybe you could talk a little bit about that, because I think a lot of the people that are listening to the show will be thinking, you know, we haven't had a lot of people on this podcast that have exited successfully their businesses. Talk to me about the thought process that led you to that decision.
Well, the business I founded when I first came here, so I moved here permanently in 2011. Obviously, I didn't have a job when, yeah, I got here, but I had quite a big network of tech friends, mainly in Europe, in the UK. And one of them was in a new business that was looking for a distributor partner in South Africa for this niche piece of technology, which integrated into a platform called SharePoint, which most people may know is a Microsoft product. I'd never heard of it before.
Yeah.
I met a technical co-founder who joined me on this journey to create this company, which was called Complexus back then. And we were basically going around and helping clients fix broken SharePoint. And then as Microsoft launched its Azure cloud computing, we started working on that kind of thing as well. So So the company was growing. I think we grew to about 22 people in 3 years. And I'm a big believer as an entrepreneur that partnering with other companies where there's a mutual white space between you is a good way to grow your business. And we'd been partnering with a large company here, and that went very well. And so we thought, well, we'll reach out to another partner. And that outreach, which I felt was a very sensible discussion around partnering, quickly turned into a conversation about being acquired, instigated by them. And yeah, it was, I guess you could call it an accidental exit. But I think what I've done a little bit of mentoring since that activity, since I sold the business. If you're very happy doing what you're doing, there's no reason why you should stop. And if you're growing or not growing, but you're enjoying it, that's great. But for me, I guess I became an accidental entrepreneur with a technology which I didn't necessarily choose to work with.
Yeah.
But I'm a big believer that, you know, I fundamentally, technology is about change. Mm. And helping clients manage change is not really about technology. It's about strategy, process, people, training, education. And the technology really then just sits like the dressing on the salad to enable these things to work. What I've found in my journey prior to that was that I've gone into a lot of clients where they're technology-led and their change programs fail. And so things like helping clients understand maturity planning, or that was always going to be the ethos that drove what we did. So it wasn't, I could have been doing any technology, it just happened to be SharePoint. Mm. So after that exit, I then genuinely wanted to get involved in something I was very passionate about from the get-go. And that's what took me into AI media, because I wanted to get into this AI automation space and learn everything about it. So yeah, it was an accidental exit.
Okay. What's very interesting about what you're saying, though, is how so many people believe because they have a proficiency, I guess, in a specific area, that you think that that is a fixed railway to pursue an ongoing journey down that space, opposed to opening up and saying, well, what else could I do? What is complementary to the skill set? How wide can I throw it open in terms of opportunity and possibility? And I think you've spoken really interestingly about that and how that path took you onto a totally different one.
Yeah, I mean, I was actually on a call with a company I'm mentoring at the moment, and there was a statistic I pulled out that, I mean, if you're selling B2B in Africa, let's say you start in South Africa, you know, there's only so many banks, there's only so many retailers you can sell to. And someone published on LinkedIn this morning, you know, the number of banks in Texas alone is kind of 10 times larger than the number of banks here, for example. Now, I'm not too sure whether that's a correct stat. Maybe that needs verifying, but if the well that you're in runs dry, you've got two things. You've got to go and find another well, or you've got to find different ways to create water.
Yeah.
One of those routes is easy, one is very difficult. Partnering, stepping outside your comfort zone, challenging yourself to say, well, if I try this, where could it take us? What's the worst that could happen? Well, we might get investment, or we might get some more customers, or we might get acquired, or we might end up merging and creating this brand new company that neither party at the very beginning knew that you were ever going to create. So I think there's nothing wrong with staying in your track, in your lane, if you want to use a swimming analogy. But if you step out of that track, then that's when some interesting things can happen. And I think we've kind of got a little bit sidetracked with this philosophy around we must build unicorns, we must become billionaires. Plenty of people have got rich not building unicorns. Plenty of people have done very well out of life with an exit which is never published about, never spoken about. It happens behind the scenes. And that's going on a lot more than people realize. And I think actually the African entrepreneurial model could do very well to focus more on the tactics and strategies for achieving that, rather than be blinded with the Silicon Valley, or you must be a unicorn, you must get Series A, Series B, Series C, da, da, da. There's a perfectly viable entrepreneurial model, which happens a lot more behind the scenes. And people can become very successful at doing that, you know, and make some money along the way.
We're going to talk quite a lot about that in today's chat. I mean, I think the other observation that I always like to make is that many people live perfectly happy lives without having made any money either.
Yep.
And I think that, you know, this obsession today of building up something to create wealth, I think is great, but that's not the secret to living a happy life. I think the secret to living a happy life, and we'll talk also probably a little bit more about this today and in the other podcasts, is to do stuff that you enjoy, that you find deeply rewarding, and then hopefully to do well as a result of that. So, Nick, what's really interesting is I saw when you sold your company that you went and did a 48,000-kilometer trip across Africa. What made you go and do something like that? You seem like an adventurous person, and you seem like a person to me, having only known you for a very short amount of time, 20 minutes maybe, to not have too many attachments to things, which I think is a very powerful state of mind. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, so I mean, just to correct the timeline there, the exit and the travel was before I came to South Africa. That, the travel is what brought me to South Africa,
really?
Actually, yeah.
Okay.
So the idea was to take 2 years off, have a career break. I never did the backpacking, post-school,
yes,
university, you know.
So you had that wanderlust.
Yeah, I was always there. I knew I always wanted to travel in a different way. I didn't, you know, yeah, to go and with a backpack to Thailand and stand around in a nightclub with a load of other people doing exactly what you do in the UK or South Africa. Over there, it does not appeal to me. So when I first came to South Africa in 2006 with my then girlfriend, who is now my wife, I kept seeing all these 4x4 vehicles with these boxes on the roof. And I said to my wife, "What? There's a Land Rover there and it's got a box on. What's inside the box?" And she said, "That's a tent." So I said, "Who camps on the roof of their car?" "Oh, well, that's what we do down here in Southern Africa. It's hot and
the lions.
You want to be off the ground because of the lions." So this planted a seed in me, and we went back to the UK after the holiday, and I did this research. I typed in Land Rover 4x4 roof tent, and I discovered this world record overlanding. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. You put a tent on the roof, and you then drive through Africa or South America or wherever it is, and this whole world of overlanding opened up. And so this is like 2006-07, so it's still pre-smartphone or just on the cusp, you know. Facebook had only, I don't think even Facebook was just being kind of, you know, it was that kind of cusp of pre-van life and everything being trendy now. So for the next 3 months, every night after work, I was just on the computer and researching this. And I discovered this one couple who went down through Western Central Africa in this Land Rover and with the roof tent. And so I went out, bought a Land Rover on eBay, got a roof tent, stuck it on. And then we were going to go in 2008, but we had the big financial crash at that moment, and we held back a little bit, and then we ended up ultimately saying, "Let's go and do it. Let's take this time off now. We're never going to get the chance to do it again." And so, yeah, we came to South Africa, got married, we took two cardboard boxes back on the plane, jumped in the Land Rover, and then drove back to here, essentially back to Cape Town. So, yeah, so the journey was. There's hardly any tourism on the route that we went. So a lot of sleeping in weird places in the bush, meeting interesting people. But I felt that I wanted to come and live and work in Africa. And I thought, if I'm going to do that, I want to see the real Africa. I don't want to see the airport, V&A waterfront, Camps Bay version of Africa, as beautiful as it is.
Yeah.
The real Africa is a lot different. And I thought, if I'm going to work here, it's important for me to understand what that looks like, what it smells like, what the people are like. And so, yeah, we went from Spain to Morocco and then down through Western Sahara, Mauritania, which was interesting. There's a minefield that you have to cross.
Can imagine,
to get into that country, and then into Senegal. So you leave the Arabic North and go into Black West Africa, and then through to Mali, Burkina Faso, then down into Ghana, Togo, Benin, Nigerian, Cameroon, Gabon, Congo, DRC, Angola, Namibia. And then we went across to Botswana, Zimbabwe, Mozambique, and then finally back to South Africa. So yeah, that was the journey to get here. And that was a year and a day.
What a remarkable thing to do. And Nick, having all of that time on the road and, you know, experiencing all of those different people and all of those cultures, I can assure you, you've explored far more of our continent than I have at 57 and a born and bred third generation South African. So let me just put that. So I'm very, very impressed, actually, in awe of that adventure. It sounds amazing. What were the thoughts that came to your mind that might have helped you develop the business idea or evolve the business idea or spark it in your own mind?
Yeah, so when I started my career, I started in the UK government, and that was where I started my career. And that brought me, the job I had there was doing technology transfer into the civil market. So using defense technology, it was actually in the environment sector, which is the sector I sort of researched during my PhD. And I kind of always drawn to the commercial sector. So after 5 years, I then joined a software company. It was a Swedish company, actually, and they had a UK operation. And I did 6 years now. I really enjoyed that. That was a sort of enterprise software space. And then I kind of awakened the entrepreneurial spirit inside me, actually through one of the acquisitions of the company I worked for. They bought this very entrepreneurial group of guys and girls, and they had a great company. And that really attracted me to build something where, you know, you create very happy customers, you've got very happy staff, and you've got a great product, and that's and I'm sort of challenge orientated. So I leapt into this sort of entrepreneurial consulting space for the time from about 2006 to 2010, and that was when I traveled after that. So when I came here, yeah, it was a blank piece of paper, and I drew on my network, which led me into this sort of accidental kind of distributor consulting business that I set up. And actually, for any entrepreneurs that are out there, particularly in the tech space, you know, or even not in the tech space, you can find a product globally right now where they don't have a market in South Africa. They're looking for distributors or resellers or value add channel partners. You know, I'm sure that's a phrase you're familiar with. And if you do your homework and you choose a product or a segment that you understand, and you can fill a gap for that company, then you can start selling that product. And actually, I'm a big fan of encouraging startups to look at different ways of generating business. And one of them is Twitter. And we had a company from Canada start following us. And I looked at their product and I thought, oh, that's quite interesting. And so I wrote to the MD and he said to me, oh, we've just been to a conference in South Africa, a trade show, and we got all these leads, but we got no one to follow up on them. Would you like to go and follow up on them for us and become a distributor for our product? So I said, yeah. And one of them was a premium retailer here in South Africa. And we went and met them and we did a pilot, and that pilot led to some more work. And then we ended up landing a 3-year support contract with them. So just from one company following my company on Twitter, I ended up getting a new product to distribute, and I ended up landing a marvelous client. And I think that's often something that's overlooked by entrepreneurs, is the signals that are around you.
Mm.
It's not just about cold calling and emailing people. There's so many different ways you can grow your business. And there are so many cues and signals that you can get in terms of a product inquiry that maybe comes through Twitter or Instagram, or someone that follows you, or whatever that thing is. And you should investigate every single one, because if you turn over enough rocks, you find, well, crayfish, that's the analogy down here, right?
Yes.
So when I mentor people who are starting out on their either sort of career in tech, whether it's a career or entrepreneurial journey, I always say, you know, you'll be surprised there's more leads around you than you realize, but you're just not really realizing, and you can't see it. It's staring you right in the face. And often the data is there, but you're just not following up on it. And actually, following up, showing up, and turning up are the three things I always say to people to think about when you're trying to progress yourself in your career, when you're trying to progress yourself with your business, maybe when you're trying to progress things like relationships. You know, turn up. If you signed up for that little networking event, turn up. You never know who's going to be there. And I see so many people sign up for things they never turn up to. And often I think a lot of people think, oh, there'll be too many people there. I'll be drowned out. I won't find who I want to meet. But it's actually the opposite way around. You often realize that a lot of people do something and then they take no action afterwards. And that's the bit that's missing. And it's that action afterwards that can get you onto someone else's radar where, you know what, you were only one of two people that followed up after that event. And I'd really like to have a conversation with you. So that's what I kind of encourage people to think about.
Mike Abel's book, Willing and Able, Lessons from a Decade in Crisis, captures the stories of clients and partners and the wins, losses, and learnings through his eyes in a career spanning 3 decades. Whether you're looking for courage or inspiration, to learn what it takes to disrupt industries, or discover how to transform your company meaningfully and truly empower your people, you'll find it between these pages. You can listen to the audiobook on Audible, download it on your Kindle, order it online, or find it at your favorite bookstore.
I mean, I talk to a lot of people and they reflect on
whether they gave up too early with something, whether they accepted defeat. And I always am reminded of J.K. Rowling, who I'll reference just now again, I guess, in a different context, but who was turned down literally by everybody with her Harry Potter books.
Yeah.
You know, she couldn't find a publisher. And then when she did, the rest, as they say, is history.
Yeah.
And I think often people give up too quickly or just don't have the tenacity or the confidence to pursue, not even a dream so much as a direction of wanting to get ahead, of wanting to push through and wanting to break through. And the other thing that you said, which was really interesting, was around seeing the signs, spotting what the universe was telling you.
Yeah, it's often there in front of you.
Exactly, exactly. You know, there's that wonderful story of that man who's driving home in New Orleans and he hears that the floodwaters are coming, the levees are going to break, and he thinks, I'm a deeply religious man, and so the Lord will provide. And then he gets home and a farmer knocks on his door and says to him, floodwaters are coming and the levees are going to break and you'll be drowned, you need to leave. And he says, no, I'm a deeply religious man, the Lord will provide. And then he's on the roof of his house. Chopper comes over, same story, drops a rope. He declines the offer. And the next thing he finds himself standing in front of the Lord at the pearly gates. And he says to him, O Lord, why did you forsake me? And he said, I sent three clear and distinct messages and you ignored them all. And I love that story because every day in business, we have those opportunities to see something, to understand something, to grasp something. And I see so many people now running away from AI. And that's back to the Harry Potter analogy, I guess, of so many people see AI as Voldemort. And I see AI as Harry Potter, as this amazing young wizard, as this thing that's going to change the world, as this thing that's going to create employment opportunities. And I guess it ties back to that old cautionary tale, and you would have done a lot of making fires at night when you were camping, of Prometheus, who stole a fire from the gods and gave it to man. And fire, as we know, can do a couple of things. It can give light and illumination. It can help you cook food. It can keep you warm, or it can burn everything down. So on to a little bit of AR. Why are you so hopeful about AR? And maybe talk to our listeners as well about AR, because I think so many people I talk to, and I'm involved in AR from many different aspects in my career, but so many people think of it as ChatGPT. There's like such a limited view on AR, what it is, what the potential is. Just run with it and start exploring.
We might need a new podcast for this one. I mean, AI is a technology, or if you consider it a subject matter, you know, it's been around a long time.
Yeah.
And then if you look at sort of the history, if you look back at, you know, Alan Turing and the fundamental work he did around Universal Machine and the early computer Colossus that came out of the Bletchley Park.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. We've been on this 80-year journey. So, you know, and there's been many, many evolutions and innovations along the way that have got us to this point now where, as of November 2022, ChatGPT got released by OpenAI and became this phenomenal thing that a lot of people are talking about now. So it's sort of that moment in the journey of a technology where it became what I call commoditized
or
became consumerized. You know, people suddenly became aware of it. You can play with it. You can go to an interface on Midjourney and start creating some art with it, and you can do stuff on your phone. So I think that was the touchstone moment where it became this more public consciousness type technology. So, and then within the discipline itself, there's many aspects to it. And I look more broadly at the industry, you know, as automation in terms of sort of process automation. So businesses like banks or telcos where you may be filling in a form traditionally that was paper or computer, and then something then processes that, which would have normally done by a human, and a decision is made and then that's handed off to a human. So this idea that AI is doing things for you in an automated or hands-off fashion, but eventually it comes back to you as a human. And then you make that final decision to award the loan or sign someone up for a bond or a mortgage. Mm. So the idea of AI as this technology that can help humans, I think, is what fundamentally sits at my core. And having spent a lot of time looking at this since sort of 2017, there's so many different, it's like analyzing a tree.
Mm.
You can see part of the tree and there's a trunk and there's branches. And then the further you go in, there's more and more branches that you see the finer structure. And then you've got the whole thing under the ground, the roots. So if you think of the roots as the infrastructure, like supercomputing, chip, you know, the big thing that you, a company called NVIDIA, which many people may or may not have heard of.
Sure.
You know, having spent time talking to that organization, I was very lucky to meet Dr. Simon See, who runs their Advanced Technology Center globally. They're fundamentally architecting the processor of the future. So they are essentially building the picks and the shovels that makes the gold mine work, essentially. Mm. So you've got this infrastructure, cloud computing, the rate of computing now has got to the point where things can run remotely, but to you on your phone or computer, they appear instantaneously. And then decision-making, data processing, and all those different avenues where AI can be applied, like character recognition, text, speech, generation of new media, film, music. There's so many avenues that you can go down. And even when you go down one of those avenues, there's many, many branches within it. So that I look at this daily, full time, and I'm barely hanging on by my fingernails. And then you look at AI for good. So I started looking at AI for business. And then I discovered this whole new branch called AI for good, AI for impact. So using AI to solve huge challenges like health, resource management, building a digital twin of the earth. So digital twins are a way of replicating, say, a car manufacturing plant, BMW, for example. They replicate their entire manufacturing process as a digital twin. They can play with the digital twin to see if they change their line, what the impact is. Well, if you zoom out and you build a digital planet, and it's an ongoing project, you can then really start to analyze like you could have never done before, things like climate change, a prediction of climate change, prediction of drought, freak weather. So you've got all of these avenues within this technology, which only 5 to 10 years ago were just a dream. You couldn't have even afforded the computer to do it. And one of the ones that really interested me, when you look at, there was a company in Europe that were developing AI for looking after elderly people. So we as a population, as a mega trend, there's going to be a lot of old people living longer and no one to look after them. Well, yep. Very few people to look after them.
Yeah.
How do we solve that problem? And so this company built a little robot with big eyes and, you know, it looked all kind of fluffy and friendly. And essentially it's got a voice agent inside it that you can talk to. And the more you talk to it, the more it responds, the more it learns about you. They've got to the point now where you can put some family history in there and friends and family and things like that. So the thing that appeals to me about it is it's just a vast, vast subject. And there's no end of use cases that you could probably apply AI to for either a commercial outcome or a for good outcome. And one of the African success stories which I came across was a company called InstaDeep, originally from Tunisia. They were founded in 2016. They decided to focus on using an avenue of AI called deep learning to solve really difficult challenges in things like drug discovery, molecular, the way molecules fit together. They recently got acquired by BioNTech, the big life pharma biosciences company. Mm. I think it was like $625 million. So, you know, that was a very successful exit in a short space of time. But they focused on solving this one or two key challenges. And then if you look at what Google have now gone on to do, I think they've published a archive now of, I think it was something like 2 million possible new molecules. And they've open sourced some of those now so researchers can work with them. And I mean, that's phenomenal. Now, there could be some ethical questions around that. And I think this is the other side of that coin. I always think of it as a two-sided coin. So the Voldemort or the bad side, you know, we have to think about privacy. We have to think about ethics. We have to think about inclusivity. Is the data set representative of the people? Let's say it's got faces in it. Is it representative of the people that we're analyzing in the population? Mm. So
get rid of bias as well.
Yeah. So, yeah, you know, we are essentially dealing with a statistical system that is prone to error.
Yeah.
And you should know the error within the algorithm or the model that you've built.
Yeah.
And then do everything to try and improve that and eliminate it over time.
Well, I'm going to tell you a funny story about that. I was asked by a publication the other day, a business publication, to send them a photograph. And I didn't want to disturb Maciek, who handles the agency brand and marketing on the weekend. And so I looked in my phone, I found a picture, but I needed to clean it up a bit. And so I entered it into AI Headshot to clean up the photograph. And I don't mind telling you the story, because for those that can't see Nick, he's follically challenged like I am. And so I entered this photograph of me to clean up the headshot. And in all of the shots that it gave back, it had removed my spectacles and it had given me hair.
Interesting.
And I thought, gosh, what is it behind this thing? To your exact point that you've raised now, taking a whole lot of people into account and saying, well, this is the likely look that he
of
would...
a successful businessman.
Yeah, well, exactly. All I really wanted to clean up was the background behind me.
Yeah, I mean, again, that is a very interesting use case. I mean, I think there was one study that was done that there was an AI model being built very similar to what you were talking about. And it was actually spending more time looking at the things in the background than it was looking at the subject matter it had been asked to look at.
Mm.
And so it started to learn nuances, which, unintended consequences. And
yes.
Again, I mean, Sam Altman published an article yesterday from OpenAI. You know, it's not necessarily killer robots or the Cyberdyne Systems Terminator scenario that could unfold. It's highly unlikely. What's more likely is the unintended consequences of AI or large applications using huge troves of data where the one thing in there that you never thought could happen does happen.
Mm.
And so I think that's where there has to be this balance in that other side of the coin, the darker side of the coin. You need to think, well, you know, what could go wrong here? And there are some frameworks now emerging which are completely abstracted, where, you know, you're looking at what's known as responsible AI. And that's one of the origins of the association, why we've created it, is to focus on that as a subject. It's very new, it's very evolving, and we're only at the beginning of it.
Well, I'm thrilled to hear you actually doing it, because a couple of years ago, well, we were the first ad agency on the continent to buy space in the metaverse in something called Ubuntu Land that was developed by Africa Rare. And well, instead of building an ad agency there, we built an art gallery there because we thought people would rather hang out in an art gallery and discuss art and whatever. But what became very clear to me early on was the ethical side of it and where it could go to in terms of either an incredibly exciting place or an incredibly dangerous space. Because when you can start mimicking and mirroring environments and identities and people, who knows where that could take you to? Because you've always got good guys and you've always got predators. I want to hear a little bit more about your AI association that you've set up, the South African AI Association, and what you're planning to do there. And then does that also include the metaverse? Are you going to be bringing in kind of a whole futuristic look at ethics in this space, or is it going to be specific to hard AI only? Because even if you look at the metaverse, right now we are kind of in the old dial-up version of the internet when you used to hear that
on the other side. That one.
Yeah.
Yeah, look, I mean, again, I think we're still at the very beginning of it. I go back to the 80-year journey since, you know, the first computer, Colossus, came. You know, this next 80 years, when you and I are long gone, unless we take some longevity pill, which is yet to be created.
No, thank you.
I'm not so keen on seeing a 150-year-old version of myself. But we're only at the beginning. And a lot of these technologies you mentioned, they are intersecting. So AI intersecting the metaverse, and then things like crypto and cryptocurrencies or blockchain or Ethereum, where, you know, things like authenticity or authentication of entities through blockchain technology, just the way those three technologies are crossing over each other, it's phenomenal. I mean, you and I could do another podcast. We could probably do 10 podcasts on that alone. So yeah, the Ubuntu Land is a great example. I mean, a colleague of mine, she runs a Bitcoin event, Sonia, you know, they do the largest African blockchain and crypto event. I mean, the dynamic in that industry and what's going on is phenomenal, because everyone thinks it's all about cryptocurrency and speculation, but actually the fundamental building blocks, the infrastructure and its applications for things, proof of work, or particularly things like identity and ownership. Again, those use cases, as computing becomes cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, to the point where it's probably compute power on your phone will be free. You just pay for a small amount of data. Then who knows what applications will emerge. So yeah, you guys pioneering in that space is really interesting. We actually have a VR AR community within AI Expo, and we actually have a physical art gallery of AI generated art. And the guys on the VR side rebuilt that as a virtual gallery with new art in it, which was AI generated on the fly. You couldn't even have done that 36 months ago.
Yeah.
That's some really high energy, exciting young entrepreneurs up in Joburg. And they put the goggles on me and it just blew me away.
Yeah.
You know, and they're doing that on the fly. So the biggest challenge, I think, for the startups in this space is, have they got the funding to sustain themselves? Because some of the use cases, if you try and explain them to a bank or a telco, they're just too on the bleeding edge for it to be practically absorbed.
Or they're driven by risk and the entrepreneur's driven by opportunity.
Yeah, it's too risky or whatever. But the reason why we created bringing it back to the association was, and I probably would have done it in, I've done it all in the wrong way, actually. I would have probably should have started with the association back in 2018 and then built the event and the magazine that we run and then the research report. But we did it the other way around.
Yeah.
Because really, to get people excited about it in 2016 was difficult. It was still very new. But now we've had government sign up. We've got commercial members, individuals, entrepreneurs, NGOs, charities, everybody now. It's the right time to start the dialogue. So our focus is on helping being a voice back to government. You know, government don't have all the answers. And at the same time, government doesn't want to be embarrassed about that. We're here to work together to help.
Too late for that.
Answer the questions. Yeah, we could have another podcast on that. We're here to help promote the idea of responsible AI, that it's an emerging topic and standard. Standards are still, and legislation is still emerging and it's new. So, yeah, it felt like the right time to launch it. I think we launched it June and July last year. We've got over 1,500 members now. Did a roadshow in Joburg, one in Cape Town. We're doing one in Durban as well. As of the 1st of March, we've got some funding, so we can now start, you know, getting the wheels turning and making it happen.
That's incredible. And I think that the other thing that I read that you do through your AI expos is to try and expose as many young people to AI as possible and the possibilities, and that you give free access, as I understand, to those expos. Do you want to talk a bit about that?
Yeah, I think when I first started looking at, I've been to a lot of tech events in my career, and I've been to some really good ones and I've been to some really awful ones. And it's the awful ones where you think, that was a bad event because it was missing this. And so when we set out with the concept of the format for AI Expo Africa, which we're doing our 7th edition this year, there was always going to be an element for young people. So we have a workshop program and we make the tickets free through our partners for that workshop program. This year, we've now got CPD accreditation for that. We're doubling the number of workshops. So that's always been a fundamental ethos behind our movement is you can't afford a 10,000 rand ticket or an 8,000 rand ticket to go to all of these events. So let's lower the barrier of entry. Let's work with our trusted partners. We've got some great partners we work with. We also work with a volunteer organization called ASIC. So we get volunteers involved and expose them to the industry. So that's a fundamental part. And then startups. So last year we had 100 vendors. We hosted 48 startups. We have startup zones, startup pavilions. We have a focus on women in AI. And we have anywhere between 33-36% female attendance, which is way above industry average. So we're trying to say to everyone, look, come. There's a price point for everybody and there's something for you to learn here. But by turning up, you will meet the industry players. You'll meet the Google in the room. You'll see Deloitte. You'll meet Accenture. And then you'll meet all these companies you've never heard of doing all this amazing stuff. I think we had a company using one of the Boston Dynamic robot dogs. And it got onto someone's TikTok channel. And I think I looked at it in January and it had 6.5 million views. So yeah, there's definitely something in there. There's creative elements, new media, art, as we mentioned. And then with the final element was getting industry involved with academia and academia involved with industry. So we have a poster zone. For anyone that's not familiar with that, it's where young researchers present their research in a poster format, which is sort of A1 or A3 size. And it's very interactive and you have to get close to the poster and have a conversation with the researcher. And we always get oversubscribed for that, but it's a great way of showing what applied research is coming out of South African and African universities. And there's some amazing use cases. There was a guy in 2019, they created a drone with a vision algorithm that could find faults in solar panels at scale. We had some interest from one of the French energy giants who were through the French embassy. They showed interest. So by showing you this applied research, you're looking at the most cutting edge stuff We've got this hodgepodge of people in the room, investors, VCs, governments, NGOs, embassies. It's a great environment where everyone can learn and meet new people and meet new technology. So that's the format.
Amazing. And it's a physical environment that we're talking about.
Yeah, we did do 2 years of online during COVID. I think the first year there was a dynamic excitement about online conferences. And then by the second year, I think people were fed up with COVID and they were fed up with online conferences. So we went back to a physical in-person event. And I think we've looked at streaming live events. The turn-up rate is so low that it's just not economically viable to do it. So yeah, we stick with the physical format now.
And how long do you think it's going to be with these advances before they are VR events?
Yeah, the VR event, again, during COVID, there was a lot of innovation around that. And yeah, there was some varying degrees. It's like a spectrum of virtual events you could go to. Totally immersive ones where you had to put on goggles.
Yeah, yeah.
And then semi-desktop browser, kind of like 3D worlds, but like varying degrees of execution on them. I think I went to one of them and I ended up floating up to the roof. And I couldn't get off the roof. It was like that scene in Willy Wonka when he goes up to the fan.
Maybe you're playing Lionel Richie's Dancing on the Ceiling.
Could have been, yeah. So COVID, there was a lot of innovation around it. I think the pure immersive virtual event format, I think to get, say, the kind of some of the people that we're targeting in our audience, it just wouldn't be possible to do that because they couldn't afford the goggles or, you know, there's a problem with everybody getting
accessibility
it.
To hardware.
You need equipment to do it, essentially. Yeah, so. Yeah. But then having a VR world within our physical world, which I, as I said, I mentioned the art gallery, we have a couple of companies that do that.
But that changes very quickly. I mean, I remember the first time I saw BlackBerry, I was in a meeting with Sir Martin Sorrell, and he was playing with this little toggle on his phone and whatever, and I looked at it and I had the old Nokia handset, neither of which really exists anymore, but they were the dominant market leaders
at the time.
Yeah.
That's right.
And I thought, wow, I would like one of those. And so when the meeting was over, I went up to Martin and he kind of said, you know, it's kind of for me and 10 Downing Street at the time, you know. And then 5 years later, everybody had a BlackBerry, you know. It was
I had a BlackBerry.
Exactly. Yeah. So in terms of the hardware now, and we've already seen, you know, Apple and their new goggles or glasses, whatever they call those things, and they look remarkable. How long do you think it is before these things are ubiquitous and pervasive? Mm.
That's a good question. I mean, I grew up, I was using a version of WhatsApp through, I think it was like a Unix computer in the computer lab at the university, and you had to know the other person when they would log on, and there was a code to type in, and then you got this green screen, and you could write in real time, and that blew me away, right?
Yes.
Obviously, now we've got this thing called WhatsApp and messaging on phones. But that was 95, that was 94, 95, and then I had my first dumb phone 96 97, and back then there was this, it was amazing just to call your friends up from the pub, or you left a voice message and you listened to it because it was like magic, right? How many people listen to voicemail now that comes through on the how many people even answer the phone now? So I think we're in this interesting time, and I particularly with social media as well, those trends that you saw with that early adoption of the technology, what seems like like when Facebook first came out, it was all about school reunions and taking pictures of your dinner and friends and family and all this other stuff. I post on Facebook now once a year. I've actually chosen to do that. I don't really go on there apart from maybe Marketplace. I think our trends and our propensity to engage with the technology, what we saw something as exciting would just be seen as, God, why did we even do that? Mm. Like texting was, or the BlackBerry. So I think, the Vision Pro, which is the Apple's headset, I think there's some very interesting use cases there. I think some guy got pulled over by the police in America in a
spaceship. Yes.
Well, the kid was driving with the goggles on. I'm not even sure whether that's allowed. I don't know
what
you're seeing. Maybe it's the map, right? I don't know. So I think some of the use cases seem quite odd because we just haven't played with the technology. Yeah. You know, I think when the first mobile phone came out, the battery pack and the phone alone was $70,000, and it lasted a couple of hours, and it was only stockbrokers in New York that could afford it. Yeah. And now look what we've got. So yeah, I think where we are with VR and headsets and that, the use case is still finding its kind of comfort zone in the consumer space, the business space, and it will. And then, yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it unfolds. I'm not sure I'm ready for a Vision Pro just yet.
I'm actually bringing a couple at the moment because I want to understand it. I want to play that. I've got the Oculus headset, obviously, and have had for a while. And it's astonishing as clunky as it is, you know, in terms of what it looks like. But it is very virtual right now. And I think that we'll obviously very soon reach a space where it's seamless, where we can't tell the difference. And that's a big opportunity. I mean, I look at the opportunities, for example, global emissions through the explosion of travel and how I can maybe go and spend a day, you know, hiking Machu Picchu from my living room in Sea Point and not have to get onto a plane to go and explore that, you know, and then it doesn't become whether or not it's accessible to everybody in the world, which would be amazing if it was, but also how it contributes to the world. And I think that, you know, we are entering more and more into this kind of borderless world online through this technology. And I think that's wildly exciting. One of the things that I saw you writing about as a benefit of AI is how to solve unemployment in South Africa. And I'm really interested in that because so many people are saying, well, AI is going to render us all unemployed. I mean, I happen to think that's rubbish, and it's back to the thing about fire either giving you warmth or burning everything down. But how do you see AI unlocking the South African economy, benefiting our economy?
Yeah, I mean, it's a complex answer, I guess, to what seems a fairly simple statement. But I see AI as creating more jobs than it will destroy. I'm on that side of that argument.
And for sure, I happen to agree with you.
And for sure, some industries will, or some parts of some industries, not all industry, you know, it won't, you know, there's a statistic I use when I talk about employment. There was somebody, they analysed 180 years worth of employment data from the USA.
Yeah.
So 180 years ago, most people were stood behind a horse, towing a plough, throwing seeds in the ground, cutting corn, whatever it was. It was farming. That's what dominated. Yeah. But then when you look at the continuum, so they normalised those industries, and then you look at the change over time. Now, farming is still around, but it's highly mechanised, in some cases automated. That the whole industry has been revolutionised through large-scale machines that, you know, you can plough a field with one person that would have taken you 100 men a year to do. You can do it in a day, right?
Yeah.
So, and while I'm not a massive fan of large-scale farming and, you know, things like emissions impact on animals, you know, I mean, methane is a massive greenhouse gas emitter that comes from the farming industry. Yeah. That industry, if you look at those stats, new industries have come along and evolved and opened up, which never were even around back then. So if you look at banking, the number of jobs has increased, or financial services, healthcare, for example. So I think it will come to add value and revolutionise existing industries, but it will add more to some and take from others. But the net will be a gain. But there will be, I think, things like business process outsourcing, BPO, where traditionally it would be someone speaking or processing an email, handling an inbound problem. AI will do the heavy lifting on that for you eventually. And you will speak to a machine and it will broadly be seamless. And you probably will be fooled into thinking it's a real person. You can do that very easily with email. But as the language processing improves, a natural conversation will be the natural outcome. So those people would then be able to do value add things. So maybe do outbound type work, a higher value chain add work. It won't solve South Africa or Africa's employment crisis. The only people that can really do that are the governments that run the country. They're the ones that have to put the enabling environments and the money behind it. Mm. And obviously, you know, there's a very interesting video that I watched about the history of Singapore and how its post-colonial society emerged and how it was governed and how it became a massive success.
Yeah.
And, you know, it did have many of the attributes that South Africa had at the end of apartheid for varying some reasons were similar, some were different. It showed how the governance and the strategic planning took that failing economy into one which Singapore now is an engine in Asia for all sorts of things. So I think we are struggling at the moment with certain things, as we all know, and probably don't need to debate on this podcast, but good governance and long-term thinking is really what will get us to a better place than we are right now. AI may help along the way, but it won't be the silver bullet to solve everything.
The Street Store turns 10 this year. The world's first rent-free, premises-free, free pop-up store provides a dignified shopping experience to those in need, allowing them to choose from a selection of pre-loved clothing and shoes. Over 1,000 stores have been hosted around the world in the past decade, and now we're calling on you to host your own. Visit thestreetstore.org to sign up and find out how.
Well, I think what's really interesting, Nick, in what you said earlier is around the predictive modeling, and without necessarily making the mistakes and paying the hard school fees through choosing the wrong strategy, if hypothetically the South African government, together with specialists, had to look at different types of modeling to say, well, let's go back to a subsistence farming kind of model where we build schools and we create things and whatever, and we have a whole lot of multiple ecosystem communities. Maybe that's more of the model than, you know, almost going back to the start, as that Willie Nelson song goes. I think he did that with Chipotle when they actually spoke about going back to authentic and original farming as opposed to what you've spoken about now. And I think that there is something wonderful in that kind of mimicking and modeling. The other thing I think is really interesting that you spoke about just now that I want to pick up on was, we spoke about the metaverse, then you spoke about blockchain technologies,
yeah.
Correct. And Ethereum and what blockchain can do. And then you're talking about AI, and I'm kind of picturing this forest in my mind where the traditional long-standing forest would be a series of redwood trees, sequoias, and we know that they last for hundreds and hundreds of years because they interconnect with their root system underground, which keeps them all standing during a storm. But I'm kind of now picturing a forest where you've got blockchain trees and where you've got AI and you've got behavioral tech. And those are the trees that all connect under the ground to create this new forest. Because it's like, for me, I always like wondered, when Henry Ford invented the Model T Ford, people would have said, okay, well, he's invented the car, that's done. But there were other companies then like Toyota and Chevrolet and GM and all the other ones, Volkswagen, that sprung up. But there were also the people that said, well, I'm going to make only windscreens, and I'm going to make shock absorbers, and I'm going to make brake pads, and I'm going to make tires, and I'm going to, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think that that's where we are right now, that is very interesting. And how do those things interconnect? So if we had to talk about interconnecting technologies like you've done, or interconnecting businesses, is there anything that you think is there for people to consider for themselves? You spoke about art just now and the generative world.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about the supply chain. So yeah, Henry Ford invented the Model T Ford, but the components that got assembled to build that car came from a raft of other suppliers, okay? So you're exactly right, Mike, that we've created these sort of behemoth new technology paradigms, and the supply chain below them, it isn't just NVIDIA building this, it isn't just Microsoft or Amazon. I read a statistic somewhere that the current gold rush is building infrastructure, but the software application layer that will sit on top of this is somewhere between 10 and 100 times more in value add and market opportunity. And we're only at the beginning of that. So I think companies that are working on things that necessarily don't necessarily think have a immediate commercial application, like caring for the elderly, for example, which is a grand challenge that we're all going to have to solve in some fashion at some point.
Yeah.
Particularly if the pension and healthcare systems collapse, which could happen. How are you going to care for people? How could you and I sit with our grandparents or grandchildren and have a conversation with them where they feel like we're in the room together, and yet you're in Cape Town and they're in Sacramento or Australia somewhere? Who's building that as a application, and then the monetization of that? I remember long distance telephone calls. You almost had to like book them. You know, it was like, I'm ringing the operator and I'm going to make a long distance telephone call. It's going to cost a lot of money, so we can't be on it for very long. If it can feel like you're sitting in a room with a loved one and yet you're separated by 10,000 miles, and that is a very real experience to them and you, that's a huge value add. And I think that is a massive problem that we're going to have to solve, and who's working on it. So the infrastructure, the picks and the shovels at that level, and then the applications that sit on it, it's a 10 to 100 times bigger market. And we're only at the beginning of it. So yeah, I encourage anyone. My brother has a son who's just got into robotics and maths at school. And I said to him I said, stick with it. That is a great subject to get passionate about.
Absolutely.
It'll be a job for life afterwards.
And it's interesting how these digital businesses empower the old style or analog ones. I mean, I've been involved with Takealot.com since inception, as their marketing partner that they brought in. And if you'd asked me right at the start of the business if I would have looked forward and seeing the power of marketplace in order to enable businesses that manufacture candles or biscuits or whatever it might be, that you're actually using a cutting edge e-commerce platform to actually enable small business. You know, people say, well, e-commerce is going to be the thing that shuts down all traditional retail. No, it's not.
No.
It's going to be a total enabler to people that might not have had access to bigger markets. I mean, I know you live in a country town. What something like that could do, or any of the other big marketplaces, is, you know, if somebody makes a particularly good chutney in your area, is give them access to the country. I'm amused, though, when you told me up front that you live in a town, and for privacy reasons, I won't divulge where you live, because you might be inundated, would-be entrepreneurs. But is there something interesting psychologically, as we head towards the tail end of our conversation, to choosing to live in a country town when you're at the cutting edge of technology?
Yeah, it just seems strange, doesn't it?
You think
I'd be a city person and living in the heart of Greenpoint, or have a flat somewhere in town. I think as I've got older, I've become a lot more introverted. I like my own company. I like to think I'm the owner of a rescue dog. I've worked from home since 2000. Well, I've been a mobile worker, if you want to call it that, since 2001. So the COVID thing, it was just, didn't impact me at all in terms of where I work. So I think I find I need long periods, or certainly periods of creativity, where it being quiet and being able to walk somewhere and just sit and think is quite important to me personally. I'm far enough away from the town for it to be close enough for me to make the effort to go there, but I'm far enough away so I've got that downtime. I can just step out of my door and start thinking creatively, and there's no distractions. So it's a choice I've made. There's some sacrifices that come with that. You know, it's a bit socially benign for me personally, but we do a stand-up on a Monday and a Friday, and the team's always in contact. And I also find that giving the team members, and we're a small company, but giving them the same freedom, you know, helps as well. You know, there's nothing worse than being, I couldn't think of anything worse actually, than being stuck in Cape Town traffic every single day, because that's lost productivity in my opinion. And I like to be productive, and it takes its toll. I mean, running a startup or running your own business is not easy. Not just because I'm in South Africa.
Yeah.
It's not easy doing it. It's tiring work. And you need to be able to switch off. So if you can eliminate a commute, or you can eliminate some drudgery, it's nice to go to your fridge and open your fridge and make your food for your lunch, right? Rather than necessarily going to the company fridge where you open it and someone stole your sandwiches. I mean, that's a silly example, obviously. But so I know there's some great work canteens out there. But yeah, so for me, it's a choice, and it comes with benefits, but it also comes with, you know, some negatives that you need to manage. But it does give me that breathing space to think creatively. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I mean, I do think that we spoke earlier about this borderless world, and, you know, whether you're living in a town an hour and a half or 2 hours away from Cape Town or not. You know, I'm chairing a company now that is based in Ireland. You know, it's a Dublin-based research company. You know, again, AI, behavioral technology, data. I don't need to be there. You know, I connect with the people, and it's all output-based. And as long as, you know, we're using our research tools to get to deeper truths with customers, who cares where I'm based, or who cares where they're based? You know, I completely understand that. In closing, Nick, so you spend a lot of time thinking, specifically thinking. Other than AR, to close with, what are you curious about right now? What are you thinking a lot about when it's not specific to your business?
Yeah, I think for me personally, I think I mentioned it earlier, I am challenge orientated. I'm thinking about what the next challenge might be. One of them is writing the second edition of the State of AI in Africa report. That's occupying a lot of my time at the moment. We've done the research, but I've got to put it together. So, you know, that's the fun bit and the hard bit. I guess I've got to a stage in my life and career where I'm thinking, what is next for me? I don't think I'll be doing what I'm doing right now forever, of course. But I think, you know, I'm the wrong side of 50, or whether 50 is the new 40, I don't know. Or 40 is the new 30.
I'm very the wrong side of
50. Yeah, well, I think you and I are on that side of the coin, right? So for me, you suddenly realize that some of your friends are passing away. You realize that there's maybe a certain finality around life that you perhaps didn't really think about or care about in your 20s or 30s or even your 40s. So I think, you know, that for me is what is next. I think there's a lot of things that could occupy my time and mind beyond what I'm doing now, in a new environment. I'm not too sure what that might be. I definitely feel there's a pull towards using some of the technologies and people I've come across to to look at that for good space, the impact space.
Yeah.
Because I think that's going to be something that dominates society as society becomes probably more polarized than it is right now.
Yeah.
And there are maybe some fundamental grand challenges that we need to solve as humans, which we're quite good at doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, there could be some things in that space, but right now I'm pretty busy. Organizing a large trade show is not easy, but once it's done and we get the next edition of the report out, then I'm always interested to talk to people about new opportunities. But yeah, we'll see what that might be.
Maybe part of your For Good initiative, I can throw a nice challenge at you, because I'm the patron of a global clothing movement for the homeless and the poor called The Street Store, which comprises four posters. And it's a pop-up clothing store that has now made its way around the world, over 1,000 of them. It'd be very interesting to think about, hey, how AI could enable or empower something like that globally. So
let's
look at that as one of your For Good initiatives. Nick, it's been fantastic having you here today. Thank you so much, and hearing how our continent's future is going to be shaped by those like you who are inventive and interested enough to harness this kind of technology. Just amazing. I wish you all the best in your mission to bring AI within reach of people in South Africa who can truly benefit from it the most and around the world. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Mike, and thanks for having me on your podcast.
Thank you so much for listening today. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not leave us a 5-star review? Tune in to Willing and Able next time for more conversations that challenge perspectives.
This podcast is produced by Two Stories, written by Linda Scarborough, produced by Carol Williams, with audio editing, engineering, and sound design by Kozim Zimela, with production assistance from MNC Saatchi Group South Africa's team, Maciek Dubla and Nadia Siegel. Special thanks to Sonic Nursery and Edible Audio for the recording of these episodes. I know it's gonna happen.